Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Golf News vodcast series Heart Matters in association with King's College Hospital London in Dubai. I'm Lachlan Kitchen, and throughout this series we'll explore engaging and informative discussions that are all about the heart. In this second episode of the series, we're going to delve into the main differences between a heart attack and heart failure and explore the role of the cardiac surgeon treating patients with heart disease. We'll also investigate the latest treatments that are available. Joining me on this episode is Dr. Baba Bashir Chowdhury, consultant cardiac surgeon at King's College Hospital London in Dubai. Dr. Chowdhury is a British surgeon with over 32 years of experience in cardiac, thoracic, and transplant surgery, having performed an incredible 6,000 adult cardiac surgical operations and 100 transplants. He has worked in the best centres in the UK and Germany and has set and led cardiac surgery and transplant programs in India and the UAE. Dr. Chowdhury, it's great to have you on the second episode. Thank you very much for coming in.
Well, thank you so much for your kind introduction. Thank you.
What are the key differences between a heart attack and heart failure?
Thank you. That's a really interesting question, which a lot of patients ask us, actually. In general terms, a heart attack can lead to heart failure. And I think the distinction is that a heart attack is usually an acute event. It's a medical emergency. Patients will often present with chest pain and then go to the emergency department for treatment. The cause of a heart attack is usually due to an impairment of blood flow into the coronary arteries, which leads to a reduction of blood flow to the supply of the muscle of the heart. We say, my cardiology colleagues say, that time is muscle. So if we leave a heart attack untreated, that segment of the heart which has been affected by the clot will inevitably die. Heart failure is a more insidious condition, so it can vary between a crashing cardiogenic shock where the blood pressure is very low and where fluid is accumulated into the body, to a more slower, insidious onset of weakness and a reduction in exercise tolerance. But heart failure, in essence, is a condition which is associated with impaired pump function of the heart. And so there are a number of causes for this. One of them is so-called ischemic heart disease or heart attacks that we've alluded to earlier. The other causes are, for example, a failure of the heart valves to work properly. Heart valves can either leak or they can be very tight, in which case blood does not flow in the right direction through the heart. Or there can be various conditions that affect the muscle primarily itself. And these all lead to this sort of clinical condition or pathophysiological condition called heart failure. So they're interlinked conditions, but they are different from one another.
For anyone who may be possibly concerned, what are some of those warning signs and perhaps the symptoms of a heart attack? So what are the warning signs and the symptoms that someone may be experiencing that people should really be aware of?
I would say, for example, if we know that in our families that we have a history of heart disease, then we should be wary that we may be having a heart attack somehow in the future. So that's the first thing. In terms of what are the acute things to be concerned about, I think if one is getting chest pain, that's a very serious symptom that demands investigation. Classically, in patients who are undergoing a heart attack, the chest pain is described as crushing, belt-like. It's usually described as a suffocating pain across the front of the chest. Often this crushing or dull chest pain may radiate into the shoulder or into the arm or into the left arm or into the jaw. Very often patients are very frightened because there's an activation of the sympathetic system. There may be nausea and sweating. So these are the cardinal symptoms essentially that we look for in patients having a heart attack. Now, not all patients will have these symptoms. Some patients can have heart attacks actually with very minimal symptoms. Women, for example, may simply complain of having vague upper abdominal pain, which may come on very suddenly, or may complain of a sudden onset of breathlessness. So I think, you know, if the classic symptoms of a chest pain arise, then I think it's very reasonable to quickly go and get emergency medical attention, have an ECG, and a blood test. And I think if anyone is concerned about other symptoms which may mimic a heart attack, then I think medical attention is crucial.
Yeah, it's obviously a lot more severe than someone that's feeling a bit of indigestion or getting some reflux. But for so, doctor, you mentioned if someone is suffering those symptoms of a heart attack, if someone does need to contact emergency services and call 998, what's your advice in how to best handle that patient who is suffering a heart attack for family and friends?
Yes, I think that's a great question. I think the first thing is to get onto emergency services as quickly as possible. That's absolutely vital. In Dubai, the paramedic services are very well versed in treating patients who are having acute coronary events. So they're absolutely the right people to contact. I would not counsel patients to be driven in cars to hospitals unless it's strictly necessary, but get the emergency services to transport the patient across to a recognised centre where they can be treated. Ideally, patients should be given a dose of aspirin. That can be safely done. And I think calm reassurance is important. It's worthwhile making the point that not all patients having a heart attack may present with chest pain or may present with benign symptoms. The first presentation of a heart attack may be a cardiac arrest where the heart stops. So education about how to deliver CPR is very important. And regrettably, sometimes life-saving maneuvers such as giving CPR may be necessary by bystanders. And okay. This is important as well.
Well, I think that's a fantastic point to contact emergency services rather than drive or get someone to drive you to the hospital.
Absolutely.
In the process. So doctor, looking at sort of recent treatments and developments, you know, over the course of your years and all of your experience, how has the management of heart failure evolved in recent years?
Thank you. That's a really interesting question. And I think the way to answer that is to say that now we have a lot of very powerful evidence from fantastic studies that have been done in this field. And what we realize now, essentially, that there's four pillars of treatments which have actually been shown to positively affect survival in patients with heart failure. And running through them quickly, we have beta blockers, which is probably one of the early discoveries which have been shown to positively affect prognosis in patients with heart failure. We have what are called aldosterone or aldactone, aldosterone antagonists, which are another class of medications. Angiotensin receptor blockers. Again, these work on the neurohormonal pathways that are responsible for some of the negative things that we see in heart failure. There's a new medication or set of medications that have come out which are very powerful, which have really made a big impact. This class of medications are called ARNIs. And also, interestingly, over the last 5 years or so, a class of diabetic medicines have been shown to really positively affect patients called SGLT2 inhibitors. So we've got really powerful new medications to use in heart failure. Going forward, actually, we now have, given that we've got all this amazing technology around, we have the availability of remote monitoring, wearable devices. So patients can actually monitor their own symptoms. The biosignals that come from wearable devices can be uploaded to the cloud. They can be supervised and observed by physicians.
So just pausing on that, because that's fascinating. Is this a wearable device and it's sort of via Bluetooth will go to a phone and then the treating physician has access to it? What's the actual process?
It's a space that's in evolution. One of the perhaps well-known studies is the Apple Watch study, actually, which was looking at patients who may develop an abnormal rhythm. And they actually found that this device could be used very effectively to monitor patients in the community. Now, the thing is that the reason why these are so useful is because patients are wandering in the street. They're doing other things. Yeah. They're not in a hospital connected to a monitor when they have these adverse symptoms. So if we can use these wearable devices to spot these changes in real time, then we can act upon them quickly and provide the treatment that they need. I mean, this is definitely, what's coming for a whole range of other conditions. This sort of idea that we're firstly, you know, constantly monitoring and taking biosignals from wearable devices and then using ambient AI to analyze the signals and determine whether there are trends that require intervention. In the community, it's a fantastic development. It's also something that's actually obviously increasingly being used inside hospitals. So one of the challenges that we face in global healthcare is that we don't have enough doctors, enough nurses. We have increased burdens of all sorts of healthcare problems. And we're now moving to be more reliant upon wearable devices. Nursing in particular, there's so few nurses in the world now, fortunately. And obviously the provision of doctors is limited in all jurisdictions. So if we can place medical devices or wearable devices onto our patients and use them to calculate, to generate early warning signals to tell us that intervention is necessary, then actually this will have the effect of being able to do more with fewer resources, and is a very positive development. And is something that we, as I say, is definitely evolving in the field of heart failure.
So having mentioned a lot of the wearables and obviously a lot of medications, on the other hand, surgery is always an option. But when is surgery or other invasive procedures the necessary option for treating heart conditions?
That's a really interesting and broad-based question, actually. And I think it's probably fair to say that we're reliant on the data that we've extracted from well-conducted, well-designed clinical trials. So that's a very important source of information. And actually, the other source of information is so-called registry data. So registry data is data about patients, which is collected essentially outside of the domain of a clinical trial. And from that, we can get really good insights, which tell us, you know, what is the sweet spot for a particular intervention. And I think in general terms, what we can safely say with great certainty is that if you're having an acute heart attack, then the best course of action is to go into the cardiac cath lab and have a stent to basically reperfuse or to recanalize the artery that is causing the heart attack. This is incontrovertible. It absolutely works. And there is really no contention about that. In patients who have established coronary artery disease but are stable, so for example, one can have a reduction in blood flow in the coronary arteries of the body. You can have angina, which is you can get chest pain on exertion, but which may not progress immediately to a heart attack. These patients are considered to have stable coronary artery disease. Now, under these circumstances, there is a certain difference of opinion. I think to put it very politely, in general terms, the public as a whole consider that if the blocked arteries cannot be opened by a cardiologist, then surgery is reasonable. But actually, the data tells us something else, and this is really important. So there's some very well-designed studies that have been done in the past. One of them is called the SYNTAX study, which asked a specific question, which is in patients with stable coronary artery disease, with a range of complexity of coronary artery disease, in which set of circumstances should a stent be used? Or coronary surgery should be used. And actually, the result is equivocal. Well, actually, no, the result is pretty clear. So if the disease is really limited, so if you have a low burden of coronary artery disease, and if the lesions are very simple and can be easily stented, then PCI is equivalent to surgery. It is non-inferior. It means that it's about as good as having an operation. If the disease is far more complex, so if there are multiple lesions, if there's lots of calcification, if it's very difficult to land a stent, then actually coronary surgery is superior. Now, the results are even more striking in patients who have diabetes. And in general terms, if you have severe coronary artery disease and diabetes, surgery, coronary surgery, is by far the best approach for you. And all the studies have shown that survival is improved at 10 years compared to stenting under these circumstances. And the evidence is so powerful to support this.
That's fascinating to hear that, because a lot of people do tend to want to think that, particularly with matters around the heart, that surgery is always going to be the last option. Is there an understanding within the patients or the community that surgery can be this effective, or it is still something that you're trying to get across to patients that no, surgery is definitely going to be give you a chance of the best possible outcome?
So I think there are two areas of, medical practice which are germane to this discussion. The first one is the issue of informed consent. I think it's always the best approach to give the options, the optionalities available to patients with respect to different treatments. I think it's always reasonable to set out the benefits as well as the risks of every procedure that we do upon a patient, and also the short-term risks, benefits, and the long-term outcomes. And the other important principle, which stems from medical ethics in general, is that our patient's autonomy or their right to choose is absolutely sacrosanct. And I think it's our duty as doctors to put the options to the patients and for them to decide. But I think one of the perceptions that is still there is somehow that, for example, surgical or coronary artery bypass graft surgery is risky. And actually what we know from the data from clinical trials and from registries is that actually it's very safe. And an example of that would be, I suppose, me. I'm 58, 59 in October this year. I don't have any comorbid conditions, but if I were to have severe coronary artery disease, I can plug my data into, for example, Euroscore 2, which is a logistic regression model, and calculate my risk of a major complication. By that, I'd mean, what is the risk of me dying at 30 days after the surgery? And in my case, I've done the calculation.
And the answer is?
0.69% for me. For somebody 50 or younger, it's 0.5%. Now, if we're looking at the broader picture, which is we're looking at what are the benefits of surgery versus the risks. Well, in this case, the benefits for me would be that my symptoms, if I have symptoms, would be relieved. And my prognosis, which is currently poor, would be improved. And without treatment, I would be probably facing either a fatal or a disabling heart attack. And surgery would mitigate those risks. And on the other balance would be the risks. And it would be safe to say that the risks are relatively small and the benefits considerably outweigh the risks. And that's the reason why we'd recommend surgery under these particular circumstances.
Well, you've convinced me. So that's...
Oh, what can I say?
That's, yeah, which I'm sure you've done with many people, because looking at that surgery, particularly open heart surgery, you know, you mentioned how it's evolved over the past few, not just years, but decades in terms of technology and patient outcomes. How has it directly changed from when you first began practicing to have open heart surgery?
I think the first thing is that when I started back in 1993, the risks were much higher. So that's the first thing. So I would say back in 1993, for a relatively fit person having first-time coronary surgery, the risk of a major complication was anything from between 2 to 5%. So now we're looking at the same, you know, somebody in the same risk profile to be around about half of 1%. So it's much safer. The next thing is that now, because of the data that we have, we understand those circumstances in which coronary surgery is likely to benefit patients, and those circumstances where, for example, a stent might be equivalent. So as I said, this is in patients with a relatively low burden of coronary artery disease. A stent has shown to be non-inferior. And finally, the technology which is associated, which supports us in doing heart surgery, has improved considerably. Most of the coronary surgeries, for example, that I do, I use the heart-lung machine. And there's several reasons for that. The first is that we can do more grafts more safely, more precisely. And the second thing is that doing coronary surgery with the heart-lung machine in itself appears to be protective in the long term. Now, we can do coronary surgery without the heart-lung machine on the beating heart. But actually, the data suggests that that's actually better for patients with more pre-morbid conditions or a particular set of circumstances where the ascending aorta is particularly hostile. So there are technical reasons why an off-pump operation might be better than an operation which is done on-pump. The pumps themselves have considerably improved. So some of the concerns about cognitive impairment after a pump run are now essentially gone because the technology is so good. And beyond that, we're actually better at looking after patients after their heart surgery. And now we've got fantastic secondary prevention. So what we know, for example, from looking at patients who've had heart attacks is that intensive lipid-lowering therapy is really important. And that's making a big difference. Similarly, making sure that the patients are on beta blockers is important. And if they have an impairment of cardiac function, making sure that they have the additional treatments, some of which we use in heart failure. all of these small incremental things have actually resulted in a stepwise improvement in the outcomes of patients after coronary surgery. So that's one thing.
It is fascinating how far it's certainly come, given especially your 30-odd years of experience. But for any patient, if you go back to the early intervention, how can early intervention significantly improve the outcome of someone who may experience a heart attack or heart failure in a patient?
So with heart attacks, I think, let's put it this way, when we're having a stroke, we need to be treated as quickly as possible. The techniques to improve the blood supply to the brain if one has a thrombosis in a major artery of the brain, the same is true of the heart. And I think the adage is that time is muscle. So once the diagnosis had been made of a what's called an ST elevation myocardial infarct, the strategy is to get the patient as quickly as possible into the cath lab and to make sure that the artery affected has been unblocked as quickly as possible. In terms of other conditions that might require an operation, in general terms, if our patients are younger and fitter, and the pathology that we're looking at actually is which may require treatment by surgery is less advanced or less unstable, shall we say, then operating on a patient in better condition is always better. And one example of that actually is in patients who have a dilated aorta. So the aorta is the main blood pipe which comes out of the heart. It supplies blood to the entire body, including the brain. And one of the things that we've seen over the last few years is that, again, with advancements in perfusion techniques, we can now replace large sections of the aorta, including the aortic arch.
Wow.
So we use a very scary but advanced technique to do this, which is called hypothermia. We perfuse the brain and the heart separately. And for some of these more technical surgeries, we cool the patient down and arrest the circulation. The results are excellent, actually. I'm doing most of these surgeries in Dubai.
Are they common in other countries or is it only in Dubai?
They are. This type of surgery is present in almost all countries. But I am one of a limited pool of surgeons who performs this surgery. There is a condition actually which mimics heart attacks called type A aortic dissection, which is the major get out of bed in the middle of the night and drive as quickly to the hospital as possible cardiac surgery scenario, where we usually have to replace quite large portions of the aorta. It's a condition which unfortunately mimics heart attacks and which has a very high mortality. The time point at which one develops a type A aortic dissection onwards, the hourly risk of death is between 1% and 2% per hour. So most patients with this condition will die within 48 hours. So it's important to have timely, rapid surgery. Now, what has changed, you asked that question, is that actually if we can get patients to hospital with this condition, now we can save far more of them than we were able to in the past because we've got the technology to do this.
When you mentioned how you might have to replace part of the aorta, what's the material? What substance are you using then on a heart?
Yeah, so we use grafts which are primarily made of woven synthetic materials such as Gore-Tex. So we would sew in a woven graft into the aorta. And depending upon the extent of the aorta that requires to be replaced, then that would determine the length of the operation and the strategies that we need to protect the brain and the circulation. It's a very big, complex subject. But as I say, you asked what's changed. And I think what's changed is that we now have the technology to do really big stuff. And that technology means that we can do it. We can do it in the UAE, we can do it in Europe, we can do it in the US, we can do it in India and in Pakistan and other places in the world. We have the technology. So we can now save more lives for our patients.
Yeah, it's an incredible time to be living in with certainly these opportunities for patients. But Doctor, we'll just go back to some of the basic terms. So let's help some people understand terms. People have often heard a double bypass or a triple bypass surgery. What do they actually involve? And what are some of the modern techniques? I know you probably touched on this before. What are some of those modern techniques for people that are having bypass surgery to help with the success rate?
So, yeah, that's a great question, actually. I mean, I often get asked this. So double or triple, it refers to the number of grafts that we're doing on the surface of the heart. Coronary bypass surgery, basically what we're doing is that we're not putting a stent. We're leaving the, if you like, the blockage in place. And what we're looking to do is to put a graft to direct blood beyond the blocked artery. So in general terms, please excuse me for being a little technical, but we use a mixture of arteries and veins. The best artery that we have that we use as a graft is called the left internal mammary artery, which runs a finger breadth lateral to the sternum, which is the breastbone. That's the best and most durable graft that we have in the body. And we use that on the most strategically important artery at the front of the heart, called the left anterior descending coronary artery. Now, I would like to plug cardiac surgery by saying that actually the LIMA, or the left internal mammary artery to LAD graft, outperforms any stent that's commercially available. And these grafts can last in excess of 25 years, which is absolutely fantastic. Now, the other arteries that we have on the surface of the heart are also important, but unfortunately, we don't have a graft necessarily as good as that which we can deploy. We have the right internal mammary artery, which is nearly as good. We have the radial artery, which is one of two arteries that supplies the hand, which once we've accurately assessed the circulation of the hand, which we can safely use. And finally, we have veins that we can take from the leg, so to use on the surface of the heart. What's changing now is, as I say, we now have clarity when we should use the surgery. That's the first thing. The next thing is that we are increasingly using smaller incisions to deliver the operation.
Which probably has a quicker recovery time.
Yes and no. I caveat that. I think, so in my case, in my practice, patients who have a standard operation through the center of the chest, the majority of my patients here at King's are going home at day four. And I think if any of my patients are listening to this, they will call in to confirm that's the case. We recently did a very complex aortic root replacement and reconstruction, sparing an aortic valve, where this particular patient went home at day four, which is an excellent result as well. So through conventional operations, because we're getting so good at it, we're actually getting really good recovery times. But some patients do wish to have a more aesthetically pleasing or cosmetically more discreet operation. So yes, it is possible to do these procedures through smaller incisions. The other technology that's being used is a robot. And the robot is really quite helpful because it's combined with incredible optics.
Is that the Da Vinci method? Is that
Da Vinci, yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty, I mean, the optics are amazing. You get an unparalleled view in 3D of what's happening. And in a way, the surgeon controls the robot from a console, which is not next to the patient, but it's in the operating theatre. And they have an incredible view. The robotic arms, in effect, miniaturize the surgeon's hands and instruments, and it means they can operate in small spaces. So as far as cardiac surgery is concerned, it's proven very useful for taking down grafts in the chest. There are surgeons who perform all aspects of the surgery within the chest for coronary surgery with a robot. That's a very small subsection of surgeons, largely based in the US, who do that. And it's also very useful for repairing the mitral valve.
It's also the same surgery. Is it possible that the doctor is not in the operating room? He can be at actually a different location and still be able to use the robotic surgery?
Yeah, I mean, there are cases reported of surgeons being in different countries who are doing the procedure. I would say that's not great practice. And the reason is that it is sometimes necessary to convert the patient to an open operation, particularly early on in the surgeon's learning curve of the robot. I would personally feel very uncomfortable operating under those circumstances. It's far better to have the team immediately next to the patient so that they can intervene in case there's a problem.
Well, you touched on some patients do want to have a more aesthetically pleasing sort of incision. That's one that's a bit more superficial, but how does having to personalize treatment for each patient, how does that play out in modern cardiothoracic surgery?
Every patient is different, actually. And we for example, the example that we cited earlier of a 50-year-old with no necessary comorbid conditions can very safely have an operation essentially of his choice, whereas an older patient with more comorbidities would need to have a carefully tailored operation. So, for example, I have operated on 80-year-olds using an off-pump technique where the aorta is very calcified and where it's very difficult to land vein grafts. So we need an alternate strategy to treat this patient effectively. So we do have a range of options now for our patients in difficult surgical circumstances where we can treat them, whereas previously we wouldn't have had these. And the next thing, of course, is I think I've alluded to this in my previous answers to you, which is that, you know, we do take our duties of care to our patients very, very seriously. And one obligation is a commitment to the autonomy of our patients, which I absolutely respect. And patients do increasingly demand incisions which are small and discreet. In India, for example, I did quite a lot of mitral surgery. So mitral conditions of the mitral valve, which is a valve which sits between the left atrium and the left ventricle. There's a lot of mitral valve disease in rural India, mitral stenosis in particular. And men and women generally are afflicted with a dysfunctional mitral valve when they're quite young and before they have got married. And very often they would prefer a discreet incision because they think that might affect their opportunities going forward. And, you know, we've got the technology, we've been trained, we have the skills. And I think if this is what the patient wants, then I think we have a duty to offer them a treatment that they're comfortable with.
Looking at some of the other outcomes for patients, I mean, you touched on how at King's, in your experience, some patients don't stay any longer than the fourth day. But with all of these new techniques, you know, what can patients expect today compared to previous years in terms of patient outcomes?
I think patients can expect a greater degree of certainty now because we've got so much data to back up what we do. So I genuinely can reassure my patients that come to me. I mean, often, you know, as we might expect, they're very apprehensive or scared about, you know, their future prospects. But I can show them graphs, I can show them the data, I can reassure them why this is the right course of action for them. At King's, we're very lucky because I work with an incredible cardiac anaesthetist who is one of the very best I've ever worked with in my entire clinical career. And he is an incredibly skilled, compassionate, wonderful human being who all my patients absolutely warm to and love.
Well, you should name him if you like him so much.
Yeah, his name is Dr. Mohammed Ghafouripour, and he's an absolute superhero. And in addition to that, we have an incredible ICU where our consultant ICU physicians are really good. So we've got really good, high quality joined up care, and our patients do exceptionally well. I would say, I don't mean to be controversial, but I would say that's not the experience that I've had in other hospitals where I've worked in the region, actually. So King's is a fantastic place to have either cardiology or cardiac surgery care.
Yeah, you've touched on how fascinating the modern day technology is, but looking forward over the next couple of years, are there any new procedures or technologies on the horizon that you think could further revolutionize heart disease treatments?
I think prevention is better than cure. I think we're moving to an era of looking at health, not in terms of illness, but in terms of prevention or wellness. I am talking to a number of quite interesting companies which are looking at technologies to reduce cholesterol. So now we're moving to injectable agents for cholesterol, which are incredibly powerful and very, very good. There's now an injectable agent which is being currently evaluated. It's actually what's called a small interfering mRNA molecule. So it's using immunological and genetic technology to suppress one of the signals that's responsible for hypertension. So it could be that we're able to actually reduce the risk of patients getting a heart attack or getting cardiac disease by a once yearly injection. So that's one thing. The next thing is I think there's going to be continual incremental gains both in terms of the technologies that are used for stents, and also in terms of the slow incremental improvements in the outcomes of coronary surgery. That's the next thing. Now, there's another important development, which I think is worth talking about, which is patients with severe heart failure. So one of the major problems is that the gold standard for patients with end-stage severe heart failure is a heart transplant. And in a way, the US actually illustrates the problem very nicely. The US has probably around, I would say, 100,000 heart transplant eligible patients, of which around 4,000, 5,000 or so are put on the transplant list per year, and of which around 3,800 to 4,000 will get a transplant. But that leaves a large pool who may not. Now, how do we bridge that gap? So they're devices that have been on the market now for probably around sort of 25 years, and they're called left ventricular assist devices. These are fascinating. So these have evolved to they're electrically driven miniaturized blood pumps, which are implanted into the apex of the heart. And what they do is that they're powered by an electrical power source, and they in effect augment the function of the heart to support patients who have a failing heart. We, again, through the research, know the sweet spot in which to use these patients. We don't use this in patients who are in crashing heart failure, but in those in whom we can see that maximum, you know, the four pillars that we've spoken about earlier have been used, that they're maximum doses. And now these patients require an infusion to keep the blood pressure up and to maintain their heart function. And it's in these patients, we call them Intermax class 3, that these patients should have an LVAD. And what's happening now, and I'm very closely involved with the company that's bringing a device to market, which I will not name, but they now have a device which is completely fully implantable. And the reason why this is so significant is that the current devices out there, the current LVADs out there, rely on the power source, which is external to the body. And it relies upon a cable which passes through the skin to the device.
So okay. You're essentially charging your heart.
In a sense, you're connected to a rechargeable battery, which is outside of your body, and you have a cable which passes through the body to the device. Now, that cable, or the driveline as it's called, is a major source of infection. And basically, 12 to 16% per year is the rate of driveline infection.
So that's where the body's rejecting the cable.
The consequences of that is either the device has to be taken out and replaced, or the patient requires a super urgent heart transplant. So current LVADs, they prolong life. They're not as good as heart transplants, but we now, with a fully implantable device, which has a rechargeable battery, which is implanted within the body, it's recharged with the same technology that you use to recharge your phone. So now what you can do is that you overnight will sleep with a gilet, which will recharge your LVAD. And then you have 16 hours or so of mobility. And these devices can be implanted and left in like a pacemaker.
This is fascinating. But is that a long-term solution, or is that to bridge a gap until the heart transplant?
Well, we think actually that this, in the right patients, may be a better solution than a heart transplant. And again, the data is very helpful because we know now, for example, if you look at 100 patients who've had a heart transplant across all comers, and if you look at the time point at which 50% of those patients will be alive, that's called the median survival point. At the moment, I think when the data was last reported, median survival after a heart transplant for all comers is around 13.5 years. Now, you're in your 30s and you need a heart transplant. So, yes, it's a very good solution. Only a minority of patients reach, you know, 25, 26 years. That's a very small percentage. Unfortunately, the majority, the lifespan is estimated around 13 years. Patients in their 20s require heart transplants. So, yes, it's a good solution. It's the best one that we have. But at the end of the day, even after a heart transplant, one's life expectancy is limited. Now, we have the potential for an implantable device. It will not reject. Importantly, when we implant a device such as a fully implantable left ventricular assist device, we're not relying upon the death of another patient, of a donor, for a heart. So it's actually a virtuous circle. So this is a very important development. So worldwide, there's something like 10,000 LVADs implanted. we envisage that with this new device that we hope to bring to market, that probably in excess of 50,000 in the first instance will be treated. So the market is considerably bigger, and we expect to treat more patients with severe heart failure. And this means that those patients who really would benefit from a heart transplant can now receive a heart transplant instead of an LVAD. So we expect outcomes to improve.
Yeah, that's a fivefold opportunity, isn't it? Yeah, that's incredible. And for many patients that are looking at all these new technologies or future technology, all the technologies that we have now, you touched on the idea that it's your responsibility to speak to the patient about what their outcomes are and what they would like to achieve. But what should any patient know about many of these risks and benefits with a lot of these modern cardiac procedures versus perhaps what would have been a more traditional method?
So I think, you know, we live in an era of a lot of information out there. Some of it's contradictory. Some of it is of poor quality. Some of it is of very high quality. And I think it's our duty, as I say, as clinicians, to point out the strength of evidence, the presence of the evidence out there supporting a particular treatment, and also the strength of the evidence supporting particular treatments that are out there. Cost is very important as well. For example, I've alluded to the use of robots in cardiac surgery. It's very expensive. The consumables for a robot are very, very expensive. It's possible to do a lot of these surgeries with conventional instruments also, but through smaller incisions. So in certain jurisdictions, it may actually be better for you to have a more, if you like, a less technologically based solution. So in some cases, more technology doesn't necessarily mean a better solution. And really, only the answer to that question will come as we accrue more data and look at the numbers.
But when you look at many of these advancements, how does that impact the decision-making process for a doctor and also when you're in discussion with your patient, when you are considering the interventions and the options available?
I would say the main thing that has developed over the last sort of 15 or 20 years is the mandatory use of what's called multidisciplinary teams. So of which actually the patient is a part. So we rely on decision-making between the surgeon, the cardiologist, immediate caregivers to the patient and their relatives themselves to come up with a consensus solution. We have a wide range of options that are available for most cardiac conditions. Some are at the sort of very, you know, cutting edge of technology. And quite frankly, some of these may be the only solution for certain patients. But for the vast majority of patients, actually, a less technologically heavy solution may in fact be just as good. So I think having an open dialogue and explaining what's available, I think that's the way forward. Not every patient needs a robot, I think is the true answer to that question. And in terms of patients, for example, who require a new heart valve, doing it conventionally is still an excellent option. There's a new technology for heart valves which has been emerging over the last 25 years or so. It's called transcatheter aortic valve replacements, where a biological valve, so a tissue valve, is passed via a catheter and placed in the aortic position. Now, this is a technology which is very effective for patients who are elderly and who would otherwise not be considered fit enough to endure open heart surgery. That said, the oldest patient I have operated on was a 97-year-old in the UK in whom I replaced his aortic valve, and he lived to 106.
Wow.
So this is an example of an elderly patient who otherwise didn't have any other comorbid conditions. So a so-called TAVR procedure isn't necessarily the best solution for a patient such as that. Whereas a 70-year-old with multiple comorbid conditions would probably be better served with a TAVR if they have chronic renal failure or if they have especially bad lungs.
But is there not the issue of when you have a 97-year-old of priority, or perhaps is it going to be more invasive to operate or have the surgery upon a patient of that age?
That's an interesting discussion. I mean, my reaction to being confronted with the need to operate on this patient was to speak to the patient, who actually was a little reluctant. He was an incredibly erudite, intelligent man who'd lived a brilliant life, whose daughter was in her early 70s, who absolutely adored her father, who actually had migrated to the US to work as a nurse. And she said, my father must have open heart surgery. So they understood the evidence. And I think he was lucky in the sense that his daughter had a very clear grasp of the data and understood that he would do very well. And there was the understanding that, do you know what, he's going to do well. And there was buy-in. So this is how that happened. So it was an interesting and instructive case.
Doctor, if you can give me the example of some of the operations that you're undertaking at King's. If a patient comes in, is it a situation of when you're operating on the heart, you need to stop the blood flow around the body in order to operate effectively?
Yeah, I mean, so at King's, we're doing some of the highest risk surgeries in the region. I'm trained in complex aortic surgery, having spent 2 years in Hanover in Germany learning from a master. I do most of what's called the type A aortic dissections in Dubai, which is a life-threatening condition, essentially where the aorta from the inside splits. The mortality rate of this condition is around 2% per hour for the first 48 hours. So most patients with this condition would be expected to die within 48 hours. So we did operate on a patient last year who presented with a type A aortic dissection. This was a relatively young patient. Obviously, a very emotive situation. We had to explain to him that the risks of surgery were high. So the risk of this surgery was around 35% is the risk of a major complication with this surgery. To do this particular surgery, we opened the chest in the midline. We used the heart-lung machine. We placed a special cannula or tube into the brachiocephalic artery. So on the right side, the brain is supplied with one branch from the aorta. We relied on the fact that the circle of Willis, which is the internal circulation at the base of the brain, was intact. So to do the surgery, what we did was that we cooled him down to around 24 degrees centigrade. In the first instance, I replaced the aorta at the level of the aortic valve. And then to complete the rest of the aortic replacement, which is the substantial part of the underside of the aortic arch, to do this procedure, we placed the patient in a head-down position and we drained the blood from the body. So essentially, it's called an asanguineous field. And after having done that, we slowly rewarmed over the next 70 minutes or so. And he made a full recovery. He's completely neurologically intact. And his stay in hospital was in the region of 10 days. And he had a very, very good result. And, you know, these are outcomes like this are not outliers now. And you asked about how surgery is changing and improving. This is just one example.
So you were saying that the body temperature reduces down to 24 degrees, but the blood in the body, you said obviously blood is needed in the brain to help it keep ticking over, but is all the blood drained from the body in the process?
Yes, actually. So obviously the heart and the brain, in fact, all the organs are very, very important, but they're more resistant to reduced blood flow. So the brain we keep separately perfused with the heart-lung machine, and the heart we protect as well. But the rest of the body we empty of blood so that we have a clear surgical field to do the surgery on the to replace the ascending aorta. So yes, the blood is drained from the rest of the body, and having completed the graft, we then put the blood back in and rewarm the patient.
And is the blood kept at 37 degrees, or do you have to bring it back in at a different temperature?
No, so having cooled the patient to 24 degrees, the blood is then put back at 24 degrees, and then it's very slowly rewarmed. We can cool relatively quickly, but we can't rewarm quickly. The rewarming process takes a long time, but the cooling process can be done relatively quickly. The blood gets damaged if we heat it quickly. So that's why the rewarming phase often takes half the time of the operation.
And there's no risk of bacterial infection in terms of the blood changing temperature?
That's actually a really, really good question. I mean, we cover our patients with carefully selected antibiotics, so that's always done. That's usually repeated every 6 hours during the surgery. There is a risk of systemic inflammation. So blood cells that or blood that's passaged for a long time in the heart-lung machine can become activated with inflammatory factors. But in this case, we didn't experience these complications. And again, it's due to the fact that the circuits we use for bypass are so good, the oxygenators are excellent, and the clinical teams I work with are aware of these potential conditions and do everything in their power to stop it from happening.
Well, Dr. Baba Bashir Chowdhury, thank you very much for joining us on this episode of Heart Matters. It's been fascinating to hear both your passion and also to hear you share your experience.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. It's been a very interesting discussion. Thank you very much.
And if you would like to learn more about heart health or find out more about this series, you can visit our website, golfnews.com/podcasts/heart-matters. And don't forget to click on the link and subscribe so you never miss a future episode of our vodcast series, Heart Matters. I'm Lachlan Kitchen. Thank you very much for joining us. And I look forward to your company on the next episode of the Golf News vodcast series, Heart Matters.